You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
I do respect this decision, but I do think it is an actual mistake, both for the US and for our planet.
US President Donald Trump announces that he will exit the Paris Climate Agreement. The world, and in fairness, quite a lot of America, replies, bye then. My guests Carlotta Ribello, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and Ed Stocker will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Venezuela's lurch a couple of steps further down the spiral, the efforts of Britain's political parties to get out the youth vote, and an Australian tennis venue learns some hard lessons about naming things after living people. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle's Carlotta Ribello, Henry Rhys Sheridan, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and joining us from our New York bureau, Ed Stocker. Welcome all. We will start with yesterday's announcement by US President Donald Trump that he would withdraw his country from the 2015 Paris Climate Change Agreement, joining non-signatory Syria, whose attention has been otherwise occupied of late, and Nicaragua, which didn't think the accord went far enough. If Trump intended to isolate the United States, the rest of the world presently seems happy enough to let him. The reaction of French President Emmanuel Macron was typical.
To all scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, responsible citizens who were disappointed by the decision of the President of the United States, I want to say that they will find in France a second homeland. I call on them, come and work here with us.
I'll go first to our New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker. Ed, as you've doubtless noticed today, the New York Daily News has reprised one of its most famous ever front pages, dating from 1975 when Gerald Ford refused to bail the city out. But they've gone with Trump to world, drop dead, as opposed to Ford to city, drop dead. Is that typical of the US media reaction?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, you get in bastions like New York and Los Angeles strong opinions against Donald Trump. I think to a certain extent, did we expect it? We thought it may happen. And then I guess the kind of US media started playing this will he, won't he sort of apprentice style reality TV game. We had the announcement, you know, at 3 p.m. Eastern time yesterday that he'd be making an announcement, you know, cable channels like CNN showing a picture of Trump and the time and the kind of countdown as they like to do. It really did feel like a kind of TV announcement, which, you know, we know Donald Trump revels on, and it seems really that the media plays the game. And then just before there seemed to be kind of leaks or announcements from Associated Press and others that he would indeed pull out of the Paris Agreement to shock and horror around the world, including a large chunk of people based in the US. You know, opinion polls have showed that, you know, a majority of Americans believe at least something needs to be done to tackle climate change. So Donald Trump, broadly speaking, this move isn't popular, and obviously, as I'm sure we'll explore more, is kind of isolating him from the world. I mean, I think what will be interesting in a way to see is, you know, what we've already to a certain extent seen is, you know, reaction from mayors such as de Blasio here in New York and Garcetti in Los Angeles, and the fact that, you know, California is, I think, the fifth largest economy in the world. They have an opportunity, despite what the federal government is doing, to lead the way on climate change. And then we have big companies as well in the US, like Microsoft and others, who are prepared to kind of make sure that their huge companies stay within the limits of the Paris Climate Accord. So although it's pretty doomsday and upsetting, there are still chances for the private sector in the US to lead the way, despite what Trump is doing.
Carlotta, as Ed points out there, it does whatever else you can say about Donald Trump, he's not pandering for an easy popularity boost here. A majority in the United States in favor of doing something against climate change. We do know that all of American industry advised him against this. All of America's political establishment, almost all of it, advised him against this. Even his own daughter apparently was against it. What's our best guess as to why he's done it?
I mean, just to annoy people, I think that's quite a good thing when it comes to Donald Trump. But in all seriousness, when it comes to Ivanka, I think we give her too much credit in the influence she might or might not have about her father. Yeah, but you didn't. But going back to how the US media reacted to the announcement, so many headlines of the sort, oh, now Ivanka can walk in defeat after not being able to convince her father. And, you know, the American political scientist, Ian Bremmer, earlier was saying something quite interesting in terms of comparison, how Ivanka roles in the White House is pretty much like Dmitry Medvedev's in the Kremlin. It's just a humanizing external face, but actually no policy impact. And I think I couldn't agree more with that. But picking up on a point that Ed was making, I think this is the only good thing coming out of this is how it is the perfect time for cities to lead the way when it comes to climate change in the United States. As he was mentioning, we saw leaders, CEOs from so many different businesses and companies of those, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook, the biggest in the US, saying that they will do all they can to meet the targets within their companies. We've seen the defiance by a group of mayors, governors, saying that they will draft some sort of plan to present to the United Nations to try to meet the greenhouse emissions target that are set under the Paris Agreement. So in a way, it is quite good to see how this has rallied up some people, but to actually do something, not just say they are against it.
Fernando, he specifically said in the speech a couple of times, I think, that he was the president for Pittsburgh, not Paris. And among those mayors that we have heard from since was the mayor of Pittsburgh, who pointed out that the city went 80% for Clinton. And also Pittsburgh now has more jobs in clean energy than it does in mining, oil and gas combined. Again, are we looking at Donald Trump just saying stuff because it popped into his head for some reason without any particular reference to verifiable reality?
Of course. And, you know, as everyone is saying here, the private sector in the US is incredibly important. And, you know, clean energy is a massive industry already in the US. I think it will continue to do well. And of course, Trump's decision, is not hugely popular. But to be honest with you, I think the average Trump voter will not care because this goes with his speech, you know, independence for the United States, that he'll protect the American workers instead of, you know, the good of the world in terms of environment. So I wonder for the people who voted Trump, I don't think they would care. Probably they would think this is good news, even though it is concerning about how the U.S. will become more and more isolated, politically at least.
Henry, is it possible, though, and it's always possible where Donald Trump's concerned, that this is basically something he saw as a fairly empty, consequence-free stunt? Because for a start, the commitments in the Paris Agreement are voluntary. Nobody was imposing anything on the United States. And also, as I understand it, the earliest the United States can leave the agreement is actually the day after the next presidential election.
I think that the calculation he made, I don't think he cares about the climate. So I think that it was consequence-free in that regard. I think that Faye's right, that this decision probably will solidify his support, or at least not lose any of his support among his core constituents, who voted for him still hold him in very high esteem. Approval ratings among people who voted for him are still very high. And, you know, his justification for pulling out was that it was economically damaging to America to remain within the agreement. I think the tragedy of the decision for the people who vote for Trump and who support Trump is that, you know, he says it's going to bring jobs back to America. It simply won't. The reason that coal is not doing so well and coal jobs have gone away is because coal's getting whipped on the market. It has nothing to do with the transfer to clean energy. And indeed, clean energy is going to fuel a huge amount of economic growth and job growth in America in the future. It may be the case that America ends up cutting its carbon emissions anyway, simply because of economic imperatives.
Ed, final quick thought from you on this one. The other part of the speech that perplexed me, at least, although it's a theme we have heard from Trump before, was this idea that the whole rest of the world has been laughing at America. Just quickly, who does that play with? Who actually believes that that's what the world is doing?
Well, I mean, surely they're going to laugh more at America now. Or, I mean, maybe tears of rage and shock. I don't know. I mean, you know, his whole posturing is about reinstating, you know, America's greatness on the world stage. And so it's not a surprise, I don't think, for him to throw things out like this. And, you know, and I think to pick up on what Henry was saying, it plays with his crowd. It plays with the people who do believe that he is standing up for the downtrodden American, who is standing up for the people who used to represent a great nation that is no more, for the so-called coal miner that doesn't really exist or may exist in popular consciousness. I think also it's just sad in a way because, like Henry was saying, clean energy is going to be a huge market in the future. If Donald Trump is kind of isolating himself and turning himself away from that, although the private sector may surge ahead anyway, he's going to lose to his foe nation of China, who is now kind of orientating itself towards exploring clean energy. So is the US losing its chance to be a global leader on clean energy and create jobs? It seems like he's really kicking himself in the teeth, although a lot of his core voters may not even realize that.
It is interesting picking up on the comment on the world laughing at the United States, just to give a snapshot of how the world feels about it. In this particular case, Nicaragua, that you mentioned at the top of this item, one of the other two nations that is now, the three nations that are not part of the Paris Agreement. Following Trump's announcement, people are now suggesting getting a group together to go and speak to President Daniel Ortega and ask him to reconsider the decision simply for the reason that there is no pride in being in the same group as the United States. So that tells you something about the world laughing at you.
Well, let's move slightly further south from Nicaragua and look at Venezuela, which is continuing to provide answers to the question of how much worse it can possibly get. Among the 61 people now known to have died in protests in the last month is a judge, Nelson Moncada, who was shot dead at a barricade in Caracas. So chaotic is the situation now that nobody appears clear on whether this was a political assassination or a mugging. Fernando, does President Nicolas Maduro at this point appear to have any ideas beyond just clinging rather grimly to power as long as he can?
I don't think so. I think he's in a very delicate position because from what I've been reading the last weeks, even members of his own cabinet are kind of starting to disagree with him. But I think things do move slowly in Venezuela. So, you know, you've seen protesters in the streets for about, I believe, 3 months now. There's been a lot of deaths, but the protests are still there and they're not stopping. So I think his position is very weakened. I don't think he would last, until the next elections, because it's unsustainable. He doesn't have majority in parliament anymore. But as I said, things in Venezuela, they move slowly. It's very difficult to remove someone from power.
Ed Stocker in New York. Maduro is, apart from clinging grimly to power, also clinging grimly to the idea that he's the victim of some vast conspiracy being orchestrated by the United States. Is that any more or less sustainable than it once was, now that it's fairly clear to anybody who cares to look that the US couldn't possibly care less about Venezuela or indeed anything much at the moment?
Look, I think it worked when Hugo Chavez was in power, when, you know, Venezuela was booming, when oil prices were high and when, you know, social projects were being funded by this the coffers being filled by oil prices. I think, Maduro's never really been in a strong position. He was a surprise choice to many when he was elected, when he was chosen as a kind of heir apparent to Chavez before he died. And he's kind of tried to replicate Chavez's gestures, even his way of speaking, his language. He's always kind of been in a weak position, and he's, I guess, been a victim of that to some extent, as in there have been some power struggles and the fact that he's grossly mismanaged his country and essentially run it into the ground. I think the fact that, you know, there's riots on the streets, you know, Caracas is one of the most violent capitals in the world now. The violence doesn't show any sign of abating, nor does the economic situation. So he's in a situation where, how long can it sustain itself? How long are people going to believe what he says? And, you know, judging by the protests that we've seen over these past few months, it doesn't look like they believe that anymore, because nothing else is going right in the country. You know, you look at South America and you feel that it's much more stable than in the past. You know, it used to be a region, a continent that was marked by coups. And we kind of thought that was over until the situation in Venezuela deteriorated. Don't forget that Hugo Chavez was deposed for a short while in a coup before being victoriously reinstated. The question that Faye asked, and it is a possibility, is whether he will survive his mandate. I think elections are scheduled for next year in Venezuela. He still has a rough ride, and it looks like he's going to continue to clamp down on freedom of expression and freedom of the press in order to try and shore up his power, really.
I've actually got a question for Ed, if that's okay. I'm interested in the role of the Organization of American States in all this, because I know that they're having fairly regular meetings to try to alleviate the situation. But I don't really know a lot about like how they work, or what they're planning, or if they're very effective. What are the chances of them making a difference on this issue?
I mean, my personal opinion is that the Organization of American States isn't particularly effective. I think one of the issues with Latin America or South America in this case is that there's so many different organizations. There's so many different regional organizations. The Organization of American States is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and kind of in a way has a kind of hark back to when the U.S. had, you know, played a big role in what was happening in South America. I think the fact that it is headquartered in the U.S. Makes it kind of lose a certain amount of gravitas. It's also kind of flip-flopped on issues in the past that haven't made it look particularly strong. I just remember the coup in Honduras was one of the big issues that the Organization of American State a few years ago was criticized for not being strong enough on. So, I mean, it seems that they've also kind of failed to a certain extent to reach a common ground on how to deal with the Venezuela situation, which again doesn't necessarily help its cause. But I think, as I was, just to go back to my previous point, I think one of the issues is that there isn't a central kind of organization, because you have UNASUR, you have MERCOSUR, you have Andean Nation, you have an Andean grouping, you have all these different sort of regional organizations that aren't quite working in harmony. And so the OAS is kind of just one more organization in there. I think South America would benefit from having one organization that really spoke for the entire region. And that's one of the reasons why it may not be able to mediate this situation particularly strongly.
I want to bring in another point to this discussion, in this case going back to my home country of Portugal. There's a huge Portuguese community in Venezuela. Around 1.8% of the population of the country are Portuguese or Portuguese descent. So that's about 500,000 Portuguese people, which for a country of under 10 million, that's a lot of people. But what's astonishing is how 75% of these Portuguese descents are from one specific island, Madeira Island, and that's around 300,000 people, but the island has a population of under 250,000. So if all of them come back, it would double the population, and that's an issue that the island is now facing. You know, we've seen since the beginning of the year, more than 1,000 people have returned from Venezuela, either crossing the border to Panama, taking a ferry, or flying over to Spain and then getting a connection flight there. And it's interesting to see the response. The Portuguese, the regional government from Madeira has asked the Portuguese government for almost like state of emergency funds, because the welfare system of the island is near collapse with all these people coming back. And you also have a really interesting way of looking at it, which is that almost describing these people coming back to where they're from, where they hold a passport from, almost as refugees, because a lot of them leave behind a business, one or two houses, everything they've ever owned because they built a life there, and are going back to an island where maybe their great-grandparents were from with just a suitcase. So they're not fleeing a war-torn nation, But, you know, it's a country sliding into anarchy.
And if I may add another point, actually, because it's happening the same thing with Brazil, actually. The north region of Brazil, a lot of is receiving a huge influx of Venezuelan immigrants. And is a very poor region. And some of the smaller towns are saying, we can't cope. So that's a very interesting topic as well.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. Ed Stocker in New York, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller. I'll be back after a very short break with Carlotta, Henry and Fernando.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, also with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlotta Rebello and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Let's look now at the UK as it enters the last week of one of the divisive, rancorous elections which now appear to be annual events. When this election was called, it was widely expected, not least by the Prime Minister who called it, that it would be an easy win for the ruling Conservative Party. However, polls have tightened, apparently in part due to a surge in youthful support for Labour's non-youthful leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Henry, there are fairly obvious echoes here of the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, in which another sort of irascible, silver-haired old socialist was able to sort of excite quite a following among the young folk. Why were they able to do that? Is it as incongruous as it looks?
The optics of it are incongruous, right? Because you've got, as you say, basically an old man appealing to lots of kind of young, sexy people who bolster their rallies, people like to take photos of. Listen, I think my understanding of kind of age cohort allegiances towards different parts of the ideological spectrum is that younger people tend to go in for slightly more utopian visions, shall we say, to a greater degree than old, cynical people. And I think that that perhaps is an enduring theme throughout political history. Why these older gentlemen have found themselves as the conduits of that particular portion of the ideological spectrum in recent years, I'm at a loss to say why. Sorry, go on. You look like you're going to say something.
I was just going to ask Fernando, is it because they do appear, whether it's true or not, authentic and unvarnished? I mean, this week in the UK, for example, we've seen Corbyn appearing on the cover of both the NME and Kerrang magazine, and it doesn't seem all that incongruous, whereas if either magazine put Theresa May on the cover, you would assume they'd been huffing petrol.
I have to say about Corbyn, I mean, I think, you know, especially the press, they're criticising so much, but he comes across in interviews as a very kind of warm and likeable person, and I think the young, of course, they like this utopian vision, but I think even a conservative leader, they would be a bit more warm, perhaps, you know, they wouldn't mind that. And to be honest, again, young people, they don't care about age. Look, I mean, they fell in love, I don't know how old Bernie Sanders is, like late 70s. I think they do like this kind of old happy grandpa kind of style.
But Faye, are you suggesting that older people do care about age? Or
no, the young people don't care about age.
No, I understand that, but I mean, that would suggest that age might be an issue on the part of people who, I don't know, who you know, it's weird. I'm... Well,
yeah, I don't think you see as many, when you look at the demographics of the vote, when it goes to the over 50s, for example, voting for a young candidate. They want someone who has, you know, some way shown that they know how to do things, that they have some sort of record to rely on. And as we were saying, the utopian visions tend to not attract that group of people. Also to mention that Corbyn also appeared this week on Shortlist, a lifestyle magazine. And I mean, reading the interviews he gave to NME and this one, Shortlist, it's interesting to see why wouldn't he appeal to the young vote? He's discussing how he wants to abolish tuition fees. He wants to wipe out student debt. He wants to do all the things that under the recent governments have been increasing. I don't know. With the young vote, you always get the same old discussion. If everyone turned and voted, they would become a powerful bloc. We all know how it all went out with the referendum, that if you divide by demographics, the result would have been very different. And the latest YouGov polls suggest exactly the same. If the vote was of under 50s, Corbyn would win, without a doubt. I just want to make a quick mention to the role that music has played in this election. Obviously, Enemy and Corbyn discusses musical tastes as well. But also, we've seen the Grime for Corbyn movement, where grime artists are rallying up behind him, which, you know, there's a deeper discussion to have there about the ethnic gap within the society and the racial gap as well. And that's why these artists are, and it's interesting that all of them are appealing to young people to vote more than anything, if it's for Corbyn or not.
Well, we should move finally along tonight to Australia, a country which venerates its sports people like few others. That being the case, when Melbourne built a new tennis arena to host matches in the Australian Open, among other events in the 1980s, it seemed reasonable to name it after Margaret Court, the champion tennis player who in 1970 became the first woman of the Open era to complete the singles Grand Slam. However, the venue now faces something of a PR conundrum, following a series of bizarre homophobic outbursts by Margaret Court. Fernando, the basic question, should the venue now be renamed?
I have to be honest, I thought a lot about this question. Because even though, of course, what she said is completely horrible, and being gay myself, I feel personally offended. But then the thing is, if we do change, then we have to change so many other things as well. But perhaps, you know, I think the court opened in the 80s. Perhaps in this particular case, it should be renamed. I mean, what she said actually is quite bad.
No, what she said is beyond bad. It's deranged. It's just weird.
And then I was talking to a colleague of ours, and then he said, "What about if what she said was about, you know, Jewish people or black people? Perhaps people will be personally offended. So perhaps with the gays should be the same thing as well."
But where do you it is a tough line to draw, Henry. Really? She was a fantastic athlete. She was an amazing tennis player, and this tribute to her is in recognition of her abilities as a tennis player, not in sort of recognition of her talents as a human being.
And in every field, I think there is a debate, or has been debate, as to the degree to which you can separate the achievements of a given person in that field from their personal views, literature. I mean, yeah, how much credence do you want to lend these views? How much weight do you want to lend them? It's difficult. I mean, the thing is, in naming the tennis court after her, you are extolling her symbolically, aren't you? We're not talking about stripping her of her tennis titles because she's said this.
True.
We're talking about potentially...
The great honour of having a great sporting venue named after you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that itself is a symbolic act. Should symbolic considerations be taken into account after the fact? I think there's a case to be made for that. One of the weird only arguments that I can think of in favour of keeping it is the kind of delicious nominative determinism of her name being Margaret Court.
I'm ceaselessly disappointed they called it Margaret Court Arena rather than Margaret Court Court, which would have been a lot funnier.
Or just be minimally say the court.
but Carlotta, the trouble is with this, and it's far from the only such argument that goes on, is that there are no hard and fast rules. You have to judge it case by case. There's some suggestion that players at the next Australian Open might express a reluctance to play their matches in that venue. If you were playing at the next Australian Open, and you know,
as I do, of course,
you do, would you be comfortable playing in an arena named after somebody who did express such views?
No, of course not. But then, I'm not most players, and most players tend to be apolitical when it comes to the game they're playing. They're entitled in themselves winning the most titles they can. So that will be an interesting debate to watch. I just think we were talking about when this was named, and it shouldn't be about rewarding good behavior that you'd have a building or a street name after you when it's done while the person still is alive. But at least it causes some sort of debate in the city hall about if that person's legacy.
That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Carlotta Ribello, Henry Rees, Sheridan Fernando, Augusto Pacheco. Thank you. Also, our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, who we heard from earlier. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Christian Radev. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu, followed by The Cinema Show. And I'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.